morning. Please be seated. All right, we have one remaining case on our 10:30 docket. DeMarcus Clay versus State of Texas. The clerk will please announce counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Neil Jones will argue for the defense, and Ms. Andrea Simmons will argue for the state.
All right. Thank you. All right, Mr. Durrance. It's probably Durrance, isn't it?
I don't care how you pronounce it.
Well,
as long as there's no expletives attached, I'm okay.
How do you pronounce it?
Well, my mother pronounces it Durrance. I pronounce it Durrance, so.
Gotcha. Well, since I look more like Mom.
May it please the court, good morning. This case is a appeal from a revocation of supervised release out of the District Court of Denton County, Texas. The issue that has been presented by the points of error is whether or not revocation has devolved into a paper chase which provides for no cross-examination and only secondary evidence. First point of error, which I'd like to point out, again, I know you're probably aware of the facts of the case, but it does bear worth repeating, that the violations which were claimed against the defendant in this case were based upon records which were allegedly received from the state of Louisiana. It was interesting to note, and it is important to note for the purposes of examination of the rules of evidence in this particular case, that the witness who was proffered by the state had no knowledge of how the records were kept. He had no knowledge of how they were acquired. He had no knowledge of any of the facts surrounding how the records were acquired. And thus, even if he was considered a custodian of records, could not predict or state that he had any that the persons involved in making whatever records they were had personal knowledge of the facts contained therein. In short, he was not a custodian of records. However, the state wants to point to an interstate compact which says that records can be transferred between state and state. A brief review of the statute, which they bulked their brief out to produce, but I'm grateful for, shows that in the introduction of that statute, it is merely for the day-to-day supervision. It is not for the admissibility of evidence. Further, the general provisions and the rest of the provisions of that statute, which is authorized under the federal law, clearly states about how it is to be done for the operation of the internal operations of the transferring authority and or returning authority, including the retake or rearrest of someone who is allegedly in violation of their probation. In short, this is a statute not about admissibility and not about the rules of evidence, but about the day-to-day operations, as is stated in the statute, of the probation department. In other words, to sue to say that they can exchange records does not supply the proper predicate for introduction of this evidence. The defendant, it's interesting to note that the defendant countered and testified contrary to all the evidence or the records which were admitted in this case.
Okay, he did admit he didn't report at noon when he was working out on the rig, right?
Yes, he was at his employment.
Yeah, but it was a sort of a true bud.
He also admitted that he had missed one payment of restitution, but that evidence goes to the defenses which were offered by him in the case.
Yeah, but let me ask you this. You know that case law that says once evidence is improperly admitted, a defendant may explain or rebut the evidence and it's not considered waiver of the objection to the admissibility? Are you
Yes.
relying on any of that case law?
No, that is correct, Your Honor. In fact, you also making reference to, and it's a point I wanted to bring before the panel today, too, is that the state tries to make great labor and pains, as they always do, to say that error wasn't preserved. The cases which involved this type of custodial evidence in criminal cases, particularly in revocation cases, where the whole line of cases, one of which you're mentioning, clearly stated that the objection had to be made, but it had to be made to the custodian or to the records, the hearsay. The problem in those line of cases which the state cites, and most of the other cases which they cite are not a proper authority because they were not published, nevertheless, even that line of cases were the ones where the counsel at trial level would object on a best evidence ground or would object on some other objection and didn't get the objection right. He didn't say this is hearsay or that this doesn't comply with business records exception and didn't make the hearsay and then try to bring it up on appeal. That's the problem in most revocation cases, or that line of cases, which said, well, they were trying to admit records, but they got them in anyway. Well, why? Because, well, they didn't really object properly. In this case, as was shown by the record in this case, there was a long discussion with the trial court as to exactly what the objection was. It was a specific objection made. And then the court when the court overruled that objection, two other significant facts happened that I think are important and which belie the state's allegations about lack of reservation of error. The records that were in question were marked and offered into evidence. And thirdly, they were specifically objected to, and then once the court overruled them, the court admitted them. Now, the state wants to make light of the fact that, well, there was no objection as to the officer, the Texas probation officer, saying, well, I take them as my records, and they were already admitted at that point. The defendant should not be required to make frivolous objections and continue to aggravate the court, as will any objection, so that you can so they can later claim that you didn't or you did preserve error.
Did you get a running objection, or do you think it was sufficient?
It was sufficient because the court admitted the documents. And once they admitted them, he admitted them in bulk or in mass. So there was no need to do it. That belies the point of what's going on here. And that also goes to my second point, and I know I'm running out of time, but I will say this. It's important to note what was in these records. They were mere reports. They were typed up. There was no indicia of reliability. They were not sealed. They were not certified. If you get a judgment if you want to admit into evidence a judgment from the same county, from a court down the hall, you've got to go get it certified. And it has to have a seal, and there's all kinds of requirements. If you want to admit a deed into evidence from that county or from a county across the state, it has to be certified by the clerk. There was no indicia of reliability here. That lack of inquiry by the court as to the indicia of reliability in this particular case clearly shows the court was not acting outside the guiding principles of the rules of evidence, particularly this one involving the admission of records which were from another out-of-state entity. But more importantly, this brings over to me my second point, which I think are more important, and that is that we will concede that under Crawford versus Washington and other constitutional cases, Supreme Court cases, a revocation proceeding is not a trial, and it does not have some of the protections that would be allowed under the Constitution. However, what has been raised by Crawford and other cases involved in that case is the question of whether or not during a revocation proceeding, how much fundamental right does one have to do cross-examination? The state has set up a perfect catch-22 for the defendant in this particular case, and this is what Crawford and other cases were speaking to. You can't set up a catch-22 which says, here's some evidence, but there's no way that you can examine or cross-examine it. You have to take it on face value, which is what happened in this particular case. It was, and as was brought up with the probation officer, and let me make sure I'm being clear here, the probation officer that testified in court, the Texas probation officer, he was even unaware that the probation officer that was allegedly supervising, thank you, the defendant in this particular case had been fired and was no longer there. In other words, had this revocation proceeding taken place in Louisiana, it is doubtful that they would have been able to muster the evidence necessary. But because that unknown officer who at some point in time sat down and allegedly typed out some report, which is not certified, was not signed, had no indicia of reliability, gets admitted into evidence, the court said, well, that's sufficient to show a preponderance of the evidence. I don't think that even really reaches a scintilla of evidence.
Let me ask, the objection at trial was just as to the Louisiana records, isn't that right?
Yes. Okay. Yes, because that was really all they had.
Okay.
With the exception of the restitution records, which had begun to be paid in and were required to be paid in Denton County in Texas, which brings up my third point. The court in this particular case completely ignored the economic defense. Once the economic defense was raised, there was no rebuttal by the state whatsoever. There was only cross-examination. But it doesn't take a Ph.D. in economics to understand that if you're living with somebody else making $600 to $800 a month, you're unemployed off and on and only relatively employed, that you have dependents, which as a condition of your probation you are to continue to support, and that you're receiving assistance in all this with no luxury to outgo, no entertainment industry, and you've only had a job, then you are in economic straits. And my client was in economic strait, and that was something that the court just failed to understand. What was even more clear was that under, as was shown in the brief by the state, they had actually shown that he had started paying restitutions, and he did admit to missing one restitution payment at a time when all these factors were working against him. In fact, to the contrary, he had a job for the first time in months, as he testified later, but the court, of course, completely ignored because it was the defendant testifying, that he had a job waiting for him which for the first time would allow him a livable wage. That is an economic defense, ladies and gentlemen, if there ever was one. Now, he had one, and he said that, and I think the court should have taken knowledge of that and did not. The court completely ignored that. For these reasons, we would respectfully request that the court find that the trial court abused its discretion in the admission of these records and refusing to recognize the economic defense and violating the fundamental fairness of the revocation proceeding and reverse this matter. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. The Supreme Court handed down Crawford. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has been chipping away at Crawford. And mostly in the PSI realm. Mm-hmm. How much of this PSI law is the state attempting to engraft onto probation revocation law?
I'm not sure I quite understand your question.
Okay. No right to confront and cross-examine
right.
on a PSI.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds to me, and excuse me if I'm misstating your position, but not just from this case, but from cases that we're seeing from all over, that there is an engrafting of the case law dealing with PSIs onto probation revocations as well. You're not entitled to confront and cross-examine the witnesses who provide evidence in a PSI, even though it's accusers of crimes extraneous to the crime you are being prosecuted for. And that same reasoning appears to be applied now by the state in dealing with probation revocation reports, dealing for example, with failure to report, failure to pay, extraneous offenses, committing new offenses, failure to support. That's one question. To what extent can we divide and separate the PSI case law from the probation, or do we lump them all together?
Oh, no, we don't lump them together. We keep them very separate.
How do we know that?
Well, two reasons. First of all, the Supreme Court, in its reversal, and I just forgot the name of the case, where they said that unless some in a PSI situation, a pre-sentence investigation is very similar to the federal pre-sentence investigation report. They have now made a ruling that, of course, that you can't just put anything in there, and that if it can not only be contested, but there is a provision for contesting it in the objections that are done to the PSI and the procedures there. In other words, the avenue for fairness is allowed. Now, in addition, they've also said that you have to be able to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt if it involves new offenses and other things which are claimed in the federal PSR, pre-sentence report. So what they're saying, what they're looking at, and I think this is where, quite frankly, I disagree with the Court of Appeals, unsurprisingly, that
Court of Appeals?
Court of Criminal Appeals.
Okay.
Yeah. That if you look at what's going on, and this is why it all goes back to an issue of fundamental fairness under Crawford, is the fact that if you look at what's going on there, there are avenues by which the defendant can examine the report, object, bring in whatever witnesses they want, and show that, in fact, what has been reported was, in fact, untrue. And there is a way to do that in the federal system. In the state system, presently, there is none. And there is no way to do that. I think that's probably where we're going to proceed, because it is a fundamental principle of Anglo-Saxon jurisprudence that you're allowed to confront your accusers. This is this type of evidence, as is here, now I'm not melding the two, but separate and apart, in both of those situations, though, in both of those situations, what you have is primarily almost a star chamber proceeding, because you have documents which are produced somewhere else by we don't know who, and we're going to just shove them up there and do the best you can with them. Well, that's not true, and it shouldn't be. And interestingly enough, the other side of this, which, of course, the federal situation has addressed, is an ability to get that. We have no rules of discovery regarding probation violation situations. Now, that's largely because they, I'm sure people will say they're administrative and they're quasi-judicial, and I understand that argument. But it doesn't negate, and I see my time has expired. It doesn't negate the fact that what we have to fundamentally recognize is that it places the defendant in an untenable situation where he cannot even exercise his right to defend himself, unlike the federal system where he at least he has an avenue. Now, I have argued before the Fifth Circuit unsuccessfully that it is not sufficient because the state, or in that case the government, has such overpowering abilities that the defendant does not have. But, of course, they reversed that now, and I wish I could remember that case. It was the Supreme Court case where they came back and it overturned all. I should remember this. I can't believe this. I'm so bad with names.
As soon as you leave, you will remember.
I'm sure I will. And the second one that came down, and basically they had to go back and review all the pre-sentence reports, and it caused a lot of mayhem and turnover.
Well, does it make a difference in your mind? And you feel free to address any of this you want to.
Thank you.
Does it make a difference in your mind that a PSI is supposed to come from an objective, neutral person in the probation department, whereas a motion to revoke comes from the adversary in the probation department?
Well, two things about that, Your Honor. I agree that a PSI should be approached by an independent and objective person. However, I disagree with the premise that the probation officer is automatically in a position of adversarial. That has been the problem with most probation departments throughout this state for years.
When there's a motion to revoke, you don't think they're the adversary?
No, I do not, and I will say this. I will say why.
All right.
Because the conditions of probation, a probation officer should not be adversarial, even though they often are. In fact, I have heard quotes from other defendants and other probation officers to the effect that they feel that is just their duty. But the problem is that a probation officer is supposed to oversee and provide guidance. How do we know that? Look at the conditions of probation in the Code of Criminal Procedure. In those conditions, they are to be allowed to visit you at your home or elsewhere. If they were in an adversarial situation, law enforcement, they'd have to go comply with all kinds of search rules and permission rules and consent rules. That's all given, because they're to be allowed to visit you at your home or work. They are allowed to visit you at any time and to observe your situation. They are to monitor you to keep you away from persons or places of disreputable or harmful character. That is a position of oversight. That is not should not be an adversarial position.
That's supervision. I'm talking about during the revocation.
During the revocation proceeding, they could be considered as adversarial if they are purely acting on behalf of the state.
So then do you treat...
But even the state is required... I apologize, I didn't mean to interrupt you. But even the state is required, under Brady and others, to at least be fair, not just nail hides to the wall. Thank you. Appreciate the court's time.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Simmons. When you finish your argument, we'll give you just an extra minute if you want to respond.
Okay. May it please the court, counsel. Andrea Simmons on behalf of the state. I really think there are two ways to handle this case. If you break it down, you have your out-of-state documents and you have your Texas documents. And really, there's a lot of interesting arguments that can be made in this case. But, of course, the easiest is the waiver issue, because as far as the Texas documents go, at trial, the sole issue that appellant was complaining about were the out-of-state documents. And if there's an exhibit that's going to be admitted, and even if we were to say that part of that exhibit were to be inadmissible and the other part is admissible, there must be an objection that about the two of them. You can't just complain that the out-of-state documents are inadmissible and then think that that same objection applies to admissible in-state documents.
What in-state documents?
The restitution payments of appellants were paid directly to the Denton County Probation Department. Actually, the appellant did a better job than the state on the record of this, of eliciting the testimony of where do those payments go. They go directly to the Denton Probation Department. So any records that substantiate a payment or a lack thereof stem from Denton County Probation Department. Thus, the entire argument as fails that he applies to the out-of-state documents.
Wait a minute. How can it fail as to the out-of-state documents when you just finished saying that they're separate and apart from the Denton County documents?
Yeah, I'm saying his argument about out-of-state documents does not apply to the in-state documents.
Okay. So
those are standing on their own.
Separate and apart.
So separate
those
and apart.
Are separate and apart.
And those Texas documents relating to restitution were properly admitted without objection. And then subsequently during the trial, appellant conceded that he missed some of his restitution payments.
But when a defendant raises inability to pay, does the state not have an obligation to show ability to pay?
Looking at the statute under 4212, Section 21C, the statute specifically says that the state has that burden when only a financial allegations are made. In this case, that's not all we had. We had the financial.
You had the financial, but if the documents from out of state were improperly admitted, since there was zero predicate, just hypothetically, if they were improperly admitted, then did you have anything other than financial?
That was actually, if this court were to find that they were, the out-of-state documents were inadmissible, which the state does not concede, I think that you would say the only thing that was proven was the financial allegations. However, the statute doesn't require what was proven, rather it requires what was alleged. And just because some of the allegations may fail, we still met the burden of proving under the statute that we alleged not only financial, we also alleged others. And then even further into that statute, the previous statute prior to the one that's in effect right now used to include the term restitution as one of the things that the economic disability burden applied to. When they then got rid of it being an affirmative defense and put the burden on the state to prove an appellant had the ability to pay but failed to do so, they then listed in what situations that applies to. And they dropped the term restitution from the statute that used to be there. It no longer is in the statute. Thus, this court can also infer that the legislature purposefully removed the word restitution from the statute, and thus that economic hardship does not apply to restitution. And there are cases that say the same. Out of some of the Texas courts of appeals, again, many of those cases are unpublished, which I do admit, but there's a lack of, sometimes you're stuck citing unpublished cases when there's a lack of case law in Texas.
Wasn't there one other violation that appellant admitted to besides the financial one?
He admitted that he also missed some of his visits with his probation officer and tried to argue that those were appropriate misses, though, because he had to work and so he couldn't make it. And, of course, there are circumstances, I'm sure, in any probation case where people have conflicts with their schedules, with their probation officer. And the probationer does not have the option to just not do what's required of him and not communicate and get work with that schedule, but just fail to appear and say, look, I was busy. That's not going to meet the standards. The person is on this to rehabilitate and to get the assistance he needs. And if he's flying in the face of that assistance and just doing what he wishes to do and then showing up at court and claiming that he was busy, it's just not sufficient. I don't believe it's sufficient in Denton County or any other county in the state of Texas. In this case, I don't believe the state had a burden to prove he had the ability to make the restitution payments at issue. Secondly, I like the Louisiana documents personally. I don't think I really had to go into as much depth in arguing them as I did in my brief, because I think that we've met our burden on the Texas documents and we've proved at least one violation, and that's sufficient. But I thought it was an interesting argument, and I'd still like to go ahead and make it, because I can tell that y'all are a little interested in it also. But the Louisiana documents, we have an entire system in place when states agree to work with each other on transferring people who are on supervision from one state to another. And the purpose of that is so we can always maintain contact and know where these individuals are. And the record also, the rules to the Interstate Commission for Adult Supervision says that part of the purpose of this system is to create a uniform system where people in different states can communicate with each other about what's happening with persons that are on community supervision. In this case, when appellant received community supervision, he asked, I would like to request to be moved to Louisiana. That is where I'm from. That's where my family is. It's where my ties are. I don't want to be in Texas. The state sent a request via the Interstate Commission on Adult Offender Supervision to Louisiana, because that's the way that you do this, to get Louisiana's permission to accept this person. Louisiana accepted it. Everything transfers per the rules of the commission, and restitution stays in Texas per the rules of the commission. And then the commission tells you, if this person does not abide by the rules in the new state, the receiving state, that receiving state can then send the information back to Texas and say, you need to get your guy. This isn't working. And that's what happened here. And all of this is done. If you look at the rules, which I attached, they're so detailed. There's this end user agreement you can't even get online. I had to contact someone from this ICAOS to figure out how this works. They have end user agreements which state, after I've done all of the courses that are required and the training that's required and I'm certified to be able to use this system of inputting and gathering information from the system about offenders, that I agree everything I put in here is accurate, true, it's verified, and it's up to date. You can count on anything I put in here. And it's a violation of my agreement if I allow anyone else to touch it or if I put something that's not true in the system, because other states have to be able to rely on that information. And that's what happened here. The appellant failed to do what was required in Louisiana. They entered the documentation into the ICOTS, which is the computer system that's governed by the ICAOS, the Commission of Adult Offender Supervision, and they transferred them. The ICAOS sent Texas, Denton County, a letter and said, your guy has absconded. Here's the information. Louisiana would like to close their case. The ball is back in your court. We then get a warrant for the appellant, bring him back to Denton County, and obtain the records off of the system that's there for our purpose, for that same purpose, to figure out what happened. And then we have documentation from Louisiana about what happened while he was there. And this information we should be able to rely on. That's why the entire system is in place. Appellant would then tell you, oh, it's not even admissible. You can't look at what happened in Louisiana. It was my request to go there, but look, y'all can't prove what I did there. Okay, well, he's created this. It was his request to go there, and now he's saying that the entire system in place that allowed him to make that transfer to begin with is faulty, and you can't rely on the system which he relied on to get his request there in the first place.
I may apply for a job at with Bill Gates or Apple.
Yeah.
And I may go to work and love my job, and get fired. And they may be as honest as the day is long, and they may be swear in order to hold their job to keep records of my employment that they're as honest as the day is long. But if I want to admit the records as a business record, I'd still better have an affidavit.
I absolutely agree. And the system...
And y'all didn't.
Well, the system that we're relying on here, their end-user agreement to access the ICOTS system has its own built-in affidavit.
But to be admissible as a business record, I mean, we have rules of evidence. And one of those rules of evidence is that if you're going to offer something as a business record, you better have an affidavit or a sponsoring witness who can testify to the things required by the business records predicate.
I understand that. In this case, Rule 803, Section 6, says that that custodian can also be the person to whom to which information is transmitted to, if that person that transmitted the information has knowledge of what's therein.
But he couldn't testify to the, when he was asked the predicate questions, he had kept saying, I don't know.
To what specific predicate questions?
Who made the entries?
He said whether Howard, he referred specifically to the document.
Whether it was somebody, you know, whether it was made at or near the time of the events recorded, personal knowledge, he couldn't answer the predicate records.
I agree that there may be some holes in the testimony of the Denton County probation officer if you were to look and try to prove up each of the requirements under 8036. I do admit that. And I think that a lot of that happens, though, first of all, because we're relying on information that's transmitted to the first section, the first requirement under 8036 is made at or near the
trial bench. It didn't happen.
I'm sorry?
Not when I was on the trial bench, it didn't happen.
What didn't happen?
Things that would be admitted without the proper predicate. Just because
they were. No, I'm saying that the specific, if you're looking at, did he say this? It's an interpretation. You're saying when he failed to answer this question in the way I feel is appropriate, it failed to prove it was a business record. However, I'm saying that we have this system in place to which the probation officer could rely on as being verified, true, correct, up to date, and that interpretation that he was able to rely on those documents from that system then does meet the requirements of the business record exception. It's an interpretation of how you look at the answer. The answer may be, no, I don't have my personal knowledge of it. However, I've relied on it from this computer system, which is put in place for the sole purpose of this. That's why it exists. It exists so that we can effectuate the terms of the compact and create a uniform system of communication between these states who've agreed, by the way, to participate in this program.
But that doesn't sound like communication amongst the states is the same as so we can provide evidence to be used at a revocation hearing. Those aren't the same things. I mean, it would be an indication that, yes, a violation has occurred in another state. But then doesn't that state still, if they want to revoke it, have to investigate it?
Do they have to investigate what happened in Louisiana and not rely on the probation officer in Louisiana? I think if Texas is then, if any person leaves the state of Texas and where the state is then required to go in and make their own independent investigation in another state outside of Texas, just so we can revoke a probation, then why would Texas ever grant a probation to begin with? We wouldn't. We're then saying, sure, go over there, and then when you mess up, that's going to increase our burden and our job duties and the cost of our taxpayers to make sure that you can go where you're happier being. We have a system in place so that we can say, you can go there. That's what you want to do, then we will agree to it, and if you mess up, there's a system in place where we can grab this information and find out what you've been doing in Louisiana or any other state, and then follow through with our jobs. Not so that we can then go to Louisiana and figure out what Louisiana's been doing. Otherwise, there's no purpose in transferring.
But there's nothing that a defendant signs before or during the time that he's requesting to go to another state that says he waives these rights.
I don't believe he's waived any right. We've met the under 8036. I believe that the information based on the record that the Denton County probation officer kept, which he kept as part of his normal business practice and his course of business as a Denton County probation officer, it contained documents both from Texas and Louisiana, and it's part of his job as a Denton probation officer who oversees out-of-state transfers to obtain information about probationers who have been transferred out of state. He's received that information from the ICOTS computer, which is between states. Then you're going to look at whether or not there's the indicia of reliability. You look at that if there's some kind of lack of trustworthiness here. And the state's only argument is there's no reason to question the trustworthiness or the verification of the documents that our probation officer received from the ICOTS system, because it's been put in place for the specific purpose of us to be able to rely upon it. Otherwise, I don't know. I see that I'm out of time.
Anything further, though, that you wanted to respond to?
I really, the state's foremost argument is the Texas documents. Error wasn't preserved about Texas documents. He admitted it. It takes one violation. It was sufficient. We didn't have to prove economic hardship because it doesn't apply to restitution and it doesn't apply to the facts of this case. Louisiana law was really just kind of threw it in there for challenge myself, and I found it quite interesting. And the more I learned about the ACOS, the more I believe that it is a system that we should be able to rely on. And I would ask this court to go the distance and find that documents that are put into that system are reliable and trustworthy, and an affidavit's not necessary because an affidavit is internally in place for that system. State would ask that you find no error and affirm the trial court's revocation of probation.
Thank you, Ms. Simmons. Mr. Durrance.
I will be very, very brief. The state makes note of the fact that they're trying to make a separation between the out-of-state documents and the restitution issue. The restitution issue is really covered under the economic defense. As Your Honor points out very correctly, just because they moved it around in a statute and don't call it restitution anymore, we don't call probation, we call it community supervision now. It didn't change all the case law that said how you should apply all that. The burden of proof was on the state. They made no finding. Second of all, I think it's disingenuous of the state at this point to use this interstate compact as some kind of smokescreen that says that it allows the trial court to dispense with the rules of evidence in court. It does not say that. The statute could have said these things. A statute could have been passed that says this makes certain evidence admissible or not admissible. But it would have been since it's a federal state, it can't comment upon state rules, and would be an intrusion there. So this doesn't mean that the trial court could dispense with the rules of evidence. In addition, I would say also that the compact itself deals with day-to-day running and has no applicability here. They think they can rely on it. Well, that's fine, but they still need to have the indicia of reliability as is required by the rules of evidence. And I want to thank the court for your time, unless you have any other questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your arguments and your briefing today. Your case is now submitted. That includes our